You're listening to Resurrection Life Podcast with your host, Father Steve Mattson and Richard Budd, the podcast of the Church of the Resurrection in Lansing, Michigan. In today's episode, we talk about the opening ceremonies of the Olympics and being in the world but not of the world. We hear a reflection on the second beatitude, "Blessed are those who mourn." And we listen to a poem by Ben Johnson, "On My First Daughter," read by Brian Fink. Welcome to Resurrection Life Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of Resurrection Life Podcast. This is your host, Richard Budd, and with me as always,
Father Steve.
Well, Father, it's been a while.
It has. I hope that all of you have enjoyed your break from the Resurrection Life Podcast. Yeah. Or maybe they've been waiting.
With bated breath, checking their phones every day.
And if not, we're
day.
Not scandalized.
No.
We obviously have not been too concerned to get back to it, although we are. I'm glad to see you again. And we're transitioning now into a new school year.
Yeah.
And so summertime was for me, and I hope it was for you and your family and others who listen, a time of rest and renewal, or at least a bit of renewal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I guess it's kind of cliche to say the summer went by so fast, but it seems like every succeeding year, the summer goes by faster.
Well, and let me just say, as someone who's got a couple of extra decades on you.
A couple of extra?
How old are you?
43.
Okay.
Just almost
shy
two?
Of two.
Okay.
Just shy of two. Well, in any case, life goes fast. I mean, you talk to retirees, and they're not retired.
No.
They're busy. Mm. And I think that that's something that we may be invited by the Lord and by circumstances to return to, that sense of slowing down. I think that the pace of our lives, technology has driven us to the point of nonstop busyness and noise. And the Lord in his time might free us from that in this way or that. And I think better for us if we take it upon ourselves and pull back to retreat.
Well, I think this is something that's being recognized not just in certain circles, but I see it across the board. People are starting to just kind of say something's got to change because we can't keep it up at this pace.
I was with some high school friends of mine last evening, went to one of their houses, and just had a great evening in conversation. There was no looking at devices. There was good food, good drink, good conversation. And I do think that connection with others in the outdoors is really part of what we were made for.
Sure.
It's an anticipation of that life of heaven, which is going to be intimate communion around the goodness of creation and the new creation in heaven.
Yeah. Well, as it seems to be every summer, it was a summer full of various news items. I think since we've been on our little break, we've had the attempted assassination of a president. We've had a presidential nominee drop out, and a new candidate take.
And I'm not going to rise to the bait and talk about all these
I'm
things.
Not, right? I'm just highlighting.
Yes,
I'm
okay.
Not saying that we're going to talk about politics. But one thing I thought would be interesting to talk about was the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, which at the time of us recording this happened 2.5 weeks ago.
That sounds right.
And it
and evidently there was some darkness in the closing ceremonies too, which
I did not watch that. But it surely generated a lot of attention, particularly around that scene of what looked like the Last Supper. There were some people trying to say, no, it wasn't the Last Supper. It was the Feast of Dionysus.
Well, I think they were basically communicating that Dionysus supplants.
Well, that's what it seemed like to me, because if you looked at the... A few things happened, right? So the lady who kind of was in the middle that represented and what could be interpreted as Christ, went on her Instagram, and she declared this the new gay testament. And shortly after, that was deleted. But the if you looked at the table of the different events that were going to, it was I don't know the French very well, but the title of that scene was meant to be a play on words.
Yeah, it was so whatever dinner is in French, so it's kind of chainy or
yeah
on the Seine. So yeah, chain so on the Seine.
And so something like the scene of the Seine of on the Seine. So it was like the scene of the Last Supper on the Seine River, and so. In French, that sounds like three of some very similar words. I think they were shocked.
This is the blindness of the world, right? They don't realize that everybody doesn't have the same mindset as they. Mm-hmm. So people who were not Christian said, "I'm not a Christian, but I find this offensive." And for good reason, but right now Christianity is in ill favor, and we shouldn't be scandalized by it. France has had a very spotty relationship with the church, let us say, even though it's the eldest mm-hmm. sister of the church, eldest daughter of the church. But we should not expect Europe or even here in the United States to be a Christian nation. Mm-hmm. We are the as Diognetus said, or the letter to Diognetus says, we're the soul. We live here, but we're not like the world.
Yeah.
And I think part of the challenge for us is that there can be a temptation to fit in, mm-hmm. and that's been the fight against modernism that we've been undertaking for the last 150 years.
Yeah, I think we get too comfortable when we've gone through centuries where we had Christian kings and Christian laws.
A sense of Christendom.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we get too comfortable thinking that that's the way it should be. The integralist movement that wants to kind of see a return to...
A robust, muscular Christianity that's going to govern.
Where Christianity is also politically governing.
It's the analog, and this sounds really unfavorable, the comparison, but it's like Catholic Sharia law.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's a sense of, we're gonna order our world according to the Christian Catholic understanding of what is right and wrong.
But that's not what Jesus...
No. He did not come to be served, but to serve. Mm-hmm. And we obviously have authority structures that we can live within, and we are citizens of a body politic, and we can speak, but we should not assume that if we have the truth that others will hear, because mm-hmm. some have eyes to see and ears to hear, and some don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you look at John, Gospel of John, chapter 15. You know, it has that beautiful beginning where it talks about Jesus being the vine and we're the branches, and we need to remain in Him. And you can find a lot of comfort reading that. But then you go a little bit further into the chapter, and Jesus says, "If the world, don't be surprised. The world was going to persecute you because it persecuted me.
That's right.
And then there will be enmity between you and the world because the world is not part of the kingdom. And so, as Christians, we can get a little bit comfortable if we live in a Christian nation. We can think that this is how it's supposed to be. But Jesus never promised us that it was going to be like that.
That's right.
So there will be some element of having to live in the world but not being of the world. But the question is like, okay, well, what does that mean for my daily life? Am I supposed to live in a battle? Or how should I approach the world around me? Should I be on Twitter constantly looking for the next battle that I have to stand up and fight for?
Actually, when I took time away, I didn't look at Twitter, which I just want you to know, listeners, that I'm still alive. I survived it.
You didn't have a stroke or anything?
No, no. I do think that whether it's YouTube or it's Instagram or it's X or Twitter, whatever you want to call it, whatever that feed is, you're trying to get another fix. Our bodies are primed for that kind of dopamine hit. Is there something new? Is there something? What else? What else? What else? What? Wait a minute. If I'm looking about what is new, I'm not able to be present right now to the people that I'm invited to love. Mm-hmm. It's the whole sphere of concern, sphere of influence. And for us Christians, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. We don't have to condemn that. We just have to be the answer to hell. We have to be, to the extent that we can, we need to fight like heaven, as Bishop Boyer said a few years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm certainly, as we talk about this, there may be somebody listening who has seen what I've posted on Twitter and said, Rich, you're a big hypocrite.
Well, and can I just say that all of us are hypocrites. And if we're not hypocrites, we're not striving to be something more than we are.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that pat myself on the back, I can acknowledge that I'm a hypocrite and I'm going to continue to be hypocritical.
No,
But this aspiration for something more, being more prayerful, more attentive, more loving, that's what we're called to do. And to live more and more in the real, mm-hmm. I think that's what's ultimately going to be satisfying. And we will become a refuge for the world in their chaotic, manic, desire for the newest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, the attraction to get caught up in it is very strong. And there's the one meme that's kind of classic, a guy who is in front of his computer in the middle of the night, and his wife comes into the room and says, are you going to bed? And he's like, I can't. There's somebody that's wrong on the internet. Like, like you personally have to take on responsibility to correct the wrongs that you see. I think we feel that pull to, well, I've got to say something. And at the end of the day, who do you think that you're actually going to change their mind? Because we're all going on the internet to say our piece. No, is anybody really going to say, I need to learn from other people on Twitter right now?
It is sobering. And I'm sad that the algorithms create either a reinforcement of our suppositions or anger and vitriol for the enemy, right? And so we're not actually, there's no sense of really engaging and of listening and of having a conversation to learn. Mm-hmm. It's about either being confirmed in my suspicions or my convictions, or it's denouncing and demeaning and criticizing, condemning those who are opposed mm-hmm. to me.
Now, I'm also not saying that there's never a place for it. When the Olympics clearly depict the gay Last Supper that is supplanted by the Feast of Dionysus, the symbolism there being Jesus giving up his life, the Last Supper, an event of self-donation, and then the Feast of Dionysus is all about hedonism.
Indulgence. Absolutely.
And so there's a clear message there. Does that mean that we just need to be silent? No, I'm not saying that. However, the times in which we need to step up and speak on something like that, I think are far fewer than, I always get confused about, is it less or fewer? Yeah. Anyways,
rare.
Exactly. For any of you that care about those things, I'll just put both out there.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyways, I think the instances in which we need to do that are more rare than we would tend to act on. I think we act way more than we actually need to.
Yeah, and I go back to when we started proclaiming the last gospel. That's the word became flesh and dwelt among us. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. I really do think that some of us, but not all of us, need to call those things out. But it's people who are in that sphere. It's not me. Mm-hmm. No one's going to care that Father Steve Mattson in Lansing, Michigan has called out the Olympic Committee for this or that, right? I mean, I may say my followers care. I haven't tweeted in quite a while. So, and when I tweeted, I mostly retweeted. So, I mean, I have used it, and I still do, because I think it's probably the best way to get unfiltered
news.
I think the real danger right now is propaganda, and so for us to be rooted in the real is really helpful. And I think just living simple, faithful lives and speaking to others from the heart, not electronically, but more person to person, face to face.
Yeah, that's the number one important thing is encountering people in the real world, right? And I think, you know, rather than seeing yourself as Jeremiah, who's got to, you know, preach the destruction of the world around us, the thing that I've been trying to do, I'm not saying this is necessarily like the gold standard or whatever, but if I do call out something in a negative way, I try to also match that with, I've said something positive. I've brought light.
Well, and I, yeah, I think the point that I'm trying to get to is how then shall we live? Mm-hmm. What are we supposed to do then?
Yeah.
Right? Europe is more than we are post-Christian. Mm-hmm. So the Christians who are there, the Catholics who are there, just need to live, you know, not exactly underground, but to an extent we're going to be forced that way. The idea that we can win the culture war and gain ascendancy and to get to the place of the integralists, no. I think it's foolhardy. It also does violence to the exhortations, the warnings that Jesus gives us, it seems to me.
Yeah, and with, you know, you brought up the algorithm a little bit earlier. The way that these social media sites are functioning is it figures out where you lean, and it just keeps feeding you that side, whether it's left or right.
Or the thing that you hate.
Oh, yeah, so, just so to get you more fired up.
They want attention. They want eyeballs because that's their bread and butter is engagement. Mm-hmm.
But I think we can start to be more formed in the way we think about the world by our Twitter feed or our favorite news station than we are by the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Well, there's no question about that.
And so I think if you're going to spend any amount of time reading Twitter or watching your favorite news channel, you should at least be spending that much time reading the Bible and the Catechism to say what Jesus and the Church have to say about these matters. Because it's really easy to fall into one side or the other, and both sides are not living the fullness of the Catechism.
Well, I guess I would say, in addition to the reading, study, it would be also time in prayer. So, yeah, and I know you're not discounting that, but I do.
I'm just talking about what is influencing your mind.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So, you know, I think as we get deeper into the fall, with the election coming, and this is all, I'll limit my political comments to this. This is going to become even more important because as time goes on, there are billions of dollars being spent to capture our minds and to try to form the way we're thinking about certain things. And we can fall deeper into this battle mentality, this kind of thinking in the ways of the world rather than the ways of Christ. And so we need to be even further rooted into the catechism, the Bible, prayer, the sacraments, etc.
Yeah, in September, there's a couple of things. Paul Stankiewicz from the Michigan Catholic Conference is going to be giving a talk at St. Martha's in their parish hall called Faithful Citizenship.
Oh, great.
So just really a reflection on the election and how we ought to think about it as Catholics. That'll be September 19th at 6:30 at St. Martha's. No need to RSVP. And then there's going to be a lecture series on Catholic social teaching by a son of the parish, Jeremy Dowsett, who works at IHM. that'll be a series of lectures, the first of which is on Tuesday, September 17th, and you can go to their website for more information, but it'll be on Catholic social teaching. I think it's once a month, and it'll begin in September. That'll be at St. Casimir. You might say, well, isn't that close? Yes, it's evidently going to be in the gym at St. Casimir. So these are local resources that we can take advantage of, and our key, I think, is to be who we are and to help each other form ourselves, and for those who have children and grandchildren, the next generations, to know the Lord, to love Him, and to serve Him in this life.
Absolutely. All right. Well, any last thoughts or comments before we wrap this up?
Well, just a brief, do pray for the various contractors. We're hoping to be able to get back into the church by... I'm not sure if middle or third week of September is possible, but that's what I'm hoping for. And just pray for all of those who've done such great work thus far, and it'll be good to be back together in our own space, even though we've had a great time at Lansing Catholic.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Just seeing some of the pictures you've shared, I've gotten getting excited.
Yeah, no, it's good.
All right, well, for another week, this is Rich.
And Father Steve.
God bless. In the Beatitudes, Jesus outlines the duties and rewards of those who are friends of God. In the following reflection from Sean O'Neill, we take a look at the second Beatitude, Blessed are those who mourn.
Blessed are those who mourn. The second Beatitude, found in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, is Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Those who have been bereaved mourn the loss of a loved one. When you think about it, grief comes to almost everyone at one time or another. Grief and mourning are a fact of life. But it was not always that way. Before Adam and Eve committed the first sin, humanity lived in harmony with God. St. Paul tells us in Romans 5:12, Through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned. What that means is that now our life on earth is finite, and unless the Lord comes back first in the second coming, all of us must face the passage from this life to the next at some time or another. Because of sin, our life on earth is what Psalm 84 calls a valley of tears. We experience the decay physically through the aging process. Tiredness, sickness, aches and pains, injuries, indigestion, neuralgia, cancer, disease, COVID-19, and ultimately death are all signs that we do not live in a glorified body like Adam and Eve or like Jesus after the resurrection. Many of us experience grief and mourning when a loved one dies, but there are other kinds of mourning too. There is a certain sadness that we all might feel when we look back at our childhood. Childhood is meant to be a time of freedom from adult responsibilities, learning about the world and security in the loving environment of a family. Some of us had childhoods that resembled that, but others experienced trauma growing up. Others of us experienced neglect of various kinds. But even if our childhood was not ideal, we might still mourn for what it could have been, what it was meant to be. For those of us who were introduced to unsuitable material or behaviour growing up, we might mourn the loss of our innocence. Similarly, we might mourn the loss of how the world used to be. We might drift into a nostalgia for a particular era of our culture, which we often mistakenly think was a simpler, purer, and more idealistic time, which we have now been deprived of. Both of these types of nostalgia for childhood and for former times often have their basis in a lack of belief that there is anything after death, that this earthly life is all there is really, and the depressing feeling that heaven is just a pipe dream. For those of us who have our doubts about the existence of a life beyond the grave, our present life takes on a much greater importance. If I cannot expect to reach heaven or don't believe heaven exists, then I will do everything in my power to prolong my life here on earth. Those who have not much faith in an afterlife tend to become somewhat hypochondriac. Every health condition becomes an enormous burden, and thousands of dollars are spent to maintain health and stretch out existence as long as possible. Anxiety reigns, and life becomes a journey of staggering from one health crisis to another. And when death eventually occurs, it is devastating for those who have no faith. The dead person has gone into oblivion, never to be seen again, and ominously, that's where we're all going to end up in the end. But for the person who believes that there is a final destination, this life takes on a whole new meaning. When Jesus tells us that those who mourn will be comforted, much of that comfort comes from the fact that we believe that the deceased person has gone to a much better place than this valley of tears. What that final destination is, of course, depends on how we live life now. There are ultimate consequences to our actions in the next life, good or bad. St. Paul speaks about this dynamic in his first letter to the Thessalonians. He says this, "Brothers and sisters, we do not want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you do not grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. For we believe that Jesus died and rose again, and so we believe that God will bring with Jesus those who have fallen asleep in him. According to the Lord's word, we tell you that we who are still alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, will certainly not precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will be with the Lord forever." These are comforting words, and they help us with the grieving process because they bring hope. There is a life beyond death for those who have fallen asleep in him. Jesus was not immune from mourning and grief. He had compassion on the widow of Nain, whose only son had just died, by raising him from the dead. Jesus had compassion on the mother who was mourning for the loss of her son. Jesus also wept at the loss of Lazarus, even though he knew he would raise him from the dead. His grief must have been at least partly due to the fact that his friend had to undergo the wrenching separation of death. What this incident tells us is that God's heart softens when he sees us in pain like bereavement. He is not cold and aloof. He is close and sympathizes with us in our pain. Psalm 34 tells us that the Lord is close to the brokenhearted and saves those who are crushed in spirit. The raising of Lazarus also indicates to us that those who mourn are also comforted by supportive relationships. And it's an example that we can follow. Grief is difficult to deal with, and our temptation might be to avoid someone who is grieving because we can't think of what to say to them. But anyone who has been bereaved knows that even a small gesture of solidarity, a word of sympathy, or an act of service is a comfort to the bereaved person. The suffering of mourning, like all pain, is allowed by God because he knows that he can bring a greater good out of it than if it had never happened. The death of Jesus seemed like the biggest disaster in history. Jesus underwent appalling levels of pain and anguish through the horrors of his passion and death. Yet what emerged was the resurrection, the ascension, and the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, none of which could have happened without Jesus' ultimate sacrifice on the cross. Going back to the Beatitude, we read that those who mourn are blessed. How are they blessed? They are blessed because they will be comforted. They will not suffer forever, and the comfort that will be accorded them will more than make up for the pain of loss. Romans 8:28 tells us as much. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. The hope that we might have, even when we mourn, culminates in the knowledge that God will, at the end of time, destroy death completely, and pain and suffering will come to an end. For those who refuse to despair in the face of death, there will be a reward. Revelation 21 tells us, "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be any mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. To the thirsty I will give water without cost, from the spring of the water of life. Those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children." Let's pray and ask God for the perseverance to trust in him, even in grief and mourning, and sorrow and suffering. Jesus, we thank you for the victory you won through your cross and resurrection, which gives us hope that we can also come to life with you. We thank you that you give us hope. Give us the grace to remain faithful to the end, knowing that our true destiny is not this life, but in the life to come, with you in heaven forever. Amen.
We finish this episode with a poem by Ben Johnson, "On My First Daughter," read by Brian Fink.
Today we will look at the poet Ben Johnson. Ben Johnson was born in London in 1572, around 8 years after William Shakespeare, and was at one time considered Shakespeare's equal in skill. Known by his contemporaries as a great wit and accomplished satirist, Johnson's plays use complicated plots and edgy humor to show up the foolish behavior of human beings. His poetry, however, reveals a deeper and more compassionate nature, particularly poems that deal with close family and friends. Like Shakespeare's, Ben Johnson's journey of faith is complicated. His father had suffered as a Protestant during the reign of Queen Mary, but Johnson converted to Catholicism as an adult while in jail for killing a man in a duel. He sustained his Catholic faith through several years and a degree of persecution, only to return to Protestantism in his later years. One aspect of Johnson's Catholic faith that he did not appear to lose, however, was his devotion to Our Lady. In more than one poem, he refers to the Blessed Mother in terms which would have brought censure from many of those espousing anti-Catholic views. A great example of this is the poem we will read today. This is an elegy entitled "On My First Daughter," written for his little girl Mary, who died at only 6 months old. This moving poem reveals both Johnson's grief for his child and his firm belief that she is now with the Queen of Heaven. Notice the poignant way that Johnson, while claiming to be comforted by the fact that his little daughter is now in heaven, reveals the deep pain of her loss. On My First Daughter, by Ben Johnson. Here lies to each her parents Ruth, Mary, the daughter of their youth. Yet all heaven's gifts being heaven's due, it makes the father less to rue. At 6 months' end she parted hence with safety of her innocence, whose soul heaven's queen, whose name she bears, in comfort of her mother's tears, hath placed amongst her virgin train, where, while that severed doth remain, this grave partakes the fleshly birth, which cover lightly gentle earth.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Resurrection Life Podcast. Please tune in next time for more conversation, reflections, and Catholic culture. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to drop us a line to give us feedback or suggest future topics to feature, write us at podcast at corelansing.org. You can find the Church of the Resurrection online at corelansing.org. Thanks for listening, and God bless.